All right. Well, just in order to try and stay on time, I tried to do about 10 slides less than I do every time. It's been going over about 15 or 20 minutes the last few times. So I was set that I want to keep this at stopping around 7. And so I'm trying to figure out where my limit is. Sometimes I know how many slides I need, but I never know how much I'm going to actually ramble in between those slides. And that's what catches me. So we're going to go ahead and get started, and then we will get into our lesson. Let's go to the Lord in prayer first. Father God, we just thank you for this time. We thank you for this opportunity to continue to grow and learn. God, we just ask that we would glorify you and honor you in all that we teach. God, we thank you for preserving your church. God, in spite of our brokenness and our failures, that even today, in our fallibility, our weaknesses, our sin, you still preserve and protect your church. And we thank you for that. What a beautiful promise that not even the gates of hell would prevail against your church. What a comfort and just grace and mercy that is, that in spite of our weaknesses, in spite of our division, in spite of our inability to move past petty things, you protect your church. And that is a blessed, blessed promise that we have. And we thank you for it. We say all of these things in your precious name of your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen. All right, so last time, if you were here, we ended right at the conflict at Milvian Bridge. Right at the conflict at Milvian Bridge. So we saw where you have Constantine in the north there in the west, and then you have Licinius there in the south. Licinius is anti-Christian, and Constantine is, at this point, just very tolerant. He's tolerant to Christianity. He believes in freedom of worship, and those two are going to come to a head there at Milvian Bridge. And so that's where we're going to pick up. Tonight, we're going to look at a new era. We're going to move into the 4th century, and things are going to begin changing for Christianity big time. Up to this point, Christianity has grown. It has become a massive, well-known movement, even underneath persecution. We've seen good and bad. We've seen churches that were bold and powerful and unshakable in their stance for the faith and being martyred for that. And then we've seen brothers and sisters who compromised, who in a moment of weakness gave in to those kind of persecutions. We've seen lots of ups and downs. We've seen the development of some of our major points of theology coming in. We've seen Tertullian giving us the Trinitas formula. We've seen Irenaeus against the Gnostics. We've seen so many interesting things develop. We've seen good and bad. And now we are going to see a new era of ungarnished peace for Christians start to take in with what we will call the conversion of Constantine moving forward. With the exception of one little moment after Constantine with an emperor named Julian the Apostate, and we'll get to him probably in 2 or 3 weeks. But other than that, this will be an ungarnished era for Christianity as now they can worship in freedom, something to this point that they had not known. So we're going to look at the Battle of Milvian Bridge. In 312, war broke out between the tolerant Constantine, who was over Britain, France, and Spain, and the anti-Christian Maxentius, who was over Italy and northwest Africa, over the rule of the western part of the empire. Who was going to be the sole ruler of the western part of the empire? That was going to be the question. Well, Constantine marched a much smaller army south to invade Italy. He was going to invade Maxentius, and he took a much smaller army. It was kind of a bold move to march a smaller army into an attack on someone with a larger army. But he was hoping he would take them by surprise. The two armies met at the Milvian Bridge, which is right on the Tiber River outside of Rome. Now, at this time, Constantine was a sun worshiper. If you remember last week, we talked about the rise of sun worship, the worship of the unconquered sun. Well, that was very much the religion that Constantine held to. The night before the battle, however, Constantine had a dream in which he saw the first two Greek letters of the name of Christ, which is Chi and Rho in the Greek. He saw those two letters, and they appeared one on top of the other in the shape of a cross. So you had Chi, which almost looked more like a T for Constantine in the vision, overneath the Rho, and it looked like a cross with the Rho sign at the top. He had this vision, and he heard these words in that vision: by this sign you will conquer. This is a picture of the Kairos sign. At this point, this was a Christian symbol, and it would be utilized specifically under the Jewish the apostate after the really as it became a bigger sign with what Constantine said he saw before his conversion. This would be branded on the foreheads of Christians under Julian the Apostate to show that they were indeed Christians, that that's why they would, and that they deserved to be inflicted the worst torture. And so if you ever see this tattoo on my arm, that's where it came from. This little memorabilia here makes for a great conversation starter with a lot of soldiers. So this was an early sign. This is the mid-3rd century, so this is right around, either right during or right after the reign of Constantine. We start seeing a lot more of these Kairos signs becoming major symbols that would mark home churches and church buildings. This would be on the outside of those church buildings. And the Kairos was symbolic because in the early church, prior to this event, whenever Christians would smuggle the manuscripts, trying to smuggle the text from one church to another across different cities, and hoping to keep them from getting caught and getting burnt, instead of having the full name Christus or Christos written out in the Greek, they would just put the Cairo on top of one another. And that was a symbol that this refers to Christ. And it was a way to subvert the message in a way that would keep the Roman authorities from catching it and burning those manuscripts. And that was one way they did it. So it's amazing that this was the sign Constantine said he saw. He said, "In this sign you will conquer." The following morning, Constantine had the Kairos symbol painted on the front of every one of his soldiers' shields. It is then said that Constantine said a prayer to the Christian God to give him victory. That day, Constantine's smaller army crushed Maxentius. It was a lopsided defeat. It wasn't even close. It wasn't even close. And Maxentius was killed in the battle. At the age of 32, Constantine became master of the West. He was the sole ruler of the western portion of the empire. And he believed that it was the Christian God that gave him victory. And from now on, he would act as both the champion and protector of the Christians. Very important change is about to take place. In 313, Licinius and Constantine agreed. Now, Licinius was the ruler of the Eastern Empire. Constantine would be the ruler of the West. And they made a pact together. They made an agreement that there would be freedom of religion throughout the whole empire. Everybody should be able to worship how they want to and be left alone. That was the rule. But Licinius broke that agreement. And so Constantine invaded the East in 324 and defeated Licinius. And after Licinius was executed, Constantine became the sole emperor of the entire Roman Empire. Once again, the empire was under the sole rule, the single rule of a single emperor, the Emperor Constantine. And this was very good news for Christians because he was very pro-Christian. So the question was Constantine actually converted? And the question I'm going to tell you today, and we'll see at the end, is only God knows. Only God knows. There's going to be very good things Constantine does that makes you go, "Man, he's a Christian." And he's going to do things you go, "He is totally not a Christian." And so, ultimately, we're going to see that God probably only knows. But here was Constantine. And Constantine was a tall, strong, handsome man. He was the epitome of what people thought a ruler should look like aesthetically. Everything about him, his physical presence, always had a very positive and imposing impact on others. He had sharp insight into people's characters and motives, and ability to strike swiftly and precisely in war and politics, and an overflowing energy in which he devoted unselfishly to the affairs of the empire. He was a very wise, very strong, very apt leader. He was well known for a high view of morality. He gave money freely. He believed that rulers were to be just, and he believed in purity regarding sexual matters. So he was a very high moral leader. He believed in high morality, which the idea, especially when it comes to his high view of sexual ethics and morality in that area, was very contrary to previous emperors. Now, you ever really look down deep into Roman Empire history and look at the past emperors, you will see that is one area that was just left to the winds. I mean, we see that even the great Caesar, Julius Caesar was an active practicing homosexual in order to gain favors, both politically and militarily. So you start reading into that and it will just make you sick, honestly. But nevertheless, Constantine was flashy and vain about his personal appearance. He liked the way he looked, and he wanted to look good. He had high morality, but he also wanted to make sure that he looked good and that people thought he looked good. And he became increasingly tyrannical as his power increased, which is not shocking. What you will see throughout church history and political history, where power increases, perversion increases. There's something about that. Where power grows, tyrannical power grows. It's almost hand in hand. Very rarely are you going to see cases in both church history and political history where a person is given unchallenged power and it does not corrupt them in one way or the other. He was often extremely suspicious regarding the loyalty of his relatives, friends, and servants. If you know anything about Roman history, you would understand probably why he thought he should not be loyal to those people around him and should question them. Something that would result even in a tragedy with his son Crispus. Constantine's acceptance of the Christian faith is to many considered the most important conversion in the history, with the exception of the Apostle Paul. For this moment would alter the religious destiny of the Roman Empire. And there's no debating that. Whether or not he was truly a Christian, his protection and his pushing for the Christian ideal changed everything. I mean, it radically changed the Roman Empire from this point on, and I would even say the affairs of Christianity from this point on. So the idea that this moment, conversion took place and was radically and altered everything next to the Apostle Paul, I mean, you're seeing a huge change of affairs. There's no debating what this conversion did for the Christian faith, both good and bad. Both good and bad. There's no doubt that for his historical influence alone, Constantine can rightly be called Constantine the Great, as he's known today. Many Christians and historians have often debated what actually happened at Milvian Bridge. Many have argued that Constantine did not sincerely embrace Christianity at all. And this argument is based upon some of his unchristian acts seen later in his life. His ordering to kill many for strictly political reasons. Or when he just had fits of rage and wanted to kill somebody. He made it happen. But the darkest of these episodes was when Constantine put his own son Crispus to death. Because his wife Fausta falsely accused him of trying to rape her. Sounds a lot like Joseph, huh? Constantine did not even give Crispus a chance to answer the charge. And he had him killed. Didn't even ask his son if he did it. Didn't give him a trial. Didn't question him. He just had him killed because of what his wife said. However, this does not immediately undermine Constantine's Christian sincerity. Now, we may say, what do you mean? Of course it does. One of the biggest things that I really want you to try and think about as you read and become a student of history is interpreting individuals within their own time frame. Because there would be a lot of people back then that would look upon how we live today and the things that we allow and go, what do you mean they let that happen? What do you mean they let men and women sit on the same side of the church together? What do you mean those things happen? And so I simply say, not saying that murder is right or that was okay then. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is social and cultural norms often dictate us far more than we give credence to them. We are unbelievably biased as individuals, much more than we give credence to. We are biased in so many ways. And one of the hardest things to do, you are reading your Bible, when you're reading through history, when you are seeking to interpret a text or try to understand anything that existed outside of your specific time frame, is to check your presuppositions and biases at the door. And that's hard. You're going to have biases, and that's not wrong. The only people times biases are wrong is when you accept that they don't exist. That's when you're in danger. When you recognize your biases, then you can check them at the door and recognize that they're there And I need to keep that to the forefront. But when you pretend like, oh, I'm not biased about anything, it's like, okay, man, good luck with that. So, yes, we can't say that this undermines his Christian sincerity completely, because there are things that he did. Constantine had nothing to gain, either politically or militarily, for professing Christian faith. Like, what would he gain from this? Nothing. The vast majority of the empire was not Christian. They were pagans. Specifically, the bureaucrats and aristocracy of the Roman Empire. They were all pagans. What did he have to gain from taking on the faith of what all they considered the poor and the meek were? That's what the Christians were. They were all poor people. They were all slaves. They were all servants. They thought, what would that benefit him? Secondly, we see that most of the army was under the cult of Mithraism. They were under the cult of Mithra. And they worshipped Mithra. And so, it wasn't like he was going to win all his soldiers over by doing this. And after his victory at Milvian Bridge, he certainly conformed outwardly to Christianity. He changed his whole life. He began to regularly attend Christian worship. Most Christians won't even do that nowadays. He listened to the longest sermons without murmuring. He didn't say, oh, well. And at this time, church services were usually 3 to 6 hours long. And observed Easter with great solemnity. He would actually fast and wear and put sackcloth on for Easter and adorn himself. And so he very much did these things. He often made speeches in his court where he condemned pagan idolatry and praised Christianity as the one true faith. In a court surrounded by people who were total pagans, he would stand there and give long speeches about how they had a false religion, how it was idolatry, and that Christianity was the one true faith. Most Christians today won't even go into their workplace and say that. During these speeches, if he were clapped or cheered, he would always direct their praise towards heaven. Do not clap for me. Do not cheer for me. Clap and cheer for Christ. Nevertheless, it is impossible for us to be sure what was really the state of Constantine's heart this side of heaven. We just don't know. We don't know what his heart was. You're going to find people on both sides of it that go, oh no, he was still a sun worshiper who just tried to appeal to Christians because he was able to see the tides of change. Others would say, no, he totally was a Christian. Look at the things that he did. And nevertheless, we can just say completely, we'll find out in heaven. We'll find out on the other side. Nevertheless, we cannot underestimate what he did for Christians. So what was church and state under Constantine? What was it like under Constantine? Constantine's conversion did not lead to Christianity becoming the official religion of the empire in Constantine's lifetime, as some like to say. The Christianity would not become the official religion of the empire until later down the road. It would not happen under Constantine's reign. But it did change the relationship between government and religion. There is one thing that took place under Constantine more than anything. It would become Christianity's entanglement with the state. That was something that became unshakable from this point forward until we get up to the Reformation, and I would even say the Radical Reformation and the Separatist movement, which take place in New England and America. As we look at Isaac Bacchus and some of the early American separatists. This was the first time the emperor had an emperor who did not look favorably on paganism. After winning the Battle of Milvian Bridge, Constantine did not offer thanks to the gods for victory. Now that was commonplace. Whenever a person would conquer and win in a battle, the first thing he would do would come into the city and he would offer sacrifices to the pagan gods. Constantine does not do that. He changes that totally. He does not offer thanks to God for victory. And that would have been a huge cultural shock at the time, that a conquering ruler would not offer sacrifices to the pagan gods of Rome. Rather, Constantine had erected a statue of himself holding a cross with the inscription, "I saved your city and set it free from the tyrant's yoke by this sign of salvation, the true proof of heroic virtue." Little backstory, and I don't know how much credence we can put into it, so that's why I say take this with a grain of salt. there are some historians who have really done a lot of research on Constantine that argue that Constantine's mother was actually a Christian, which is why he had such an affinity towards him. His father was not, but his mother was. And so there are some who argue that, and I've read some very good journals on that, and it's hard to say. They make some very good cases to where his mother might have been a Christian. And in light from how quickly Constantine picks up on Christian practice, as well as some of his understanding of Christian doctrine, tells me that this was not his first run-in, right? Like, he was not just figuring this out as he went. He had some sort of a basis to allow him to have understandings of the Christian. Maybe he had just read, maybe he had done more research on them as he was seeking to rule and understand the different religious groups in the empire. We don't know, but it's just an interesting thought that perhaps his mother may have been a Christian. He introduced into his court a Spanish Christian bishop named Hosius of Cordova as a special advisor on church affairs. This was totally unattested for at any other point in the Roman Empire, to have a Christian advisor on your staff. Even today, our presidents have Christian advisors on their staff. I think Billy Graham was a spiritual advisor to, like, I can't even remember how far he went back to, but he was an advisor to a lot of presidents. And so this is something that's interesting. This started with Constantine, and even in our government today, we still see spiritual advisors to the president or the leader. It's kind of interesting. In 321, Constantine passed a law making Sundays an official day of rest for the entire empire. He utilized his own money to build church buildings and gave financial gifts to individual congregations. In Rome, he gave Bishop Melchiades the ancient palace of the Laterani family. And this would eventually become known as the Lateran Palace of the Pope. You can see it today. You go to Italy, where famous Western church councils would eventually meet. So a lot of our ecumenical, they're called the Lateran Councils, if you ever hear that. They took place here at this home of the Laterani family, which Constantine gave to the Bishop of Rome. He also built the beautiful church of St. John the Lateran, which is still Rome's cathedral church today. He made Christian bishops into a part of the empire's legal structure. Now, this is when things start changing big time. He decreed that in a civil dispute, the two parties could take their case to the local bishop if they so desired, and the bishop's decision would have all the force of the law. Things are really starting to get intertangled here already. The church and the state are becoming one. Never before would bishops have the authority of the state behind them. And this is where that is going to start taking place. Constantine introduced a system of state welfare in the form of child maintenance grants to the poor. And this was to discourage the killing of unwanted infants at birth. Killing babies has always been a part of our history. It just always happened. Abortion in America, Roe v. Wade, is not novel. From whether it was offering babies to Moloch and Baal, or just killing them because you couldn't take care of them, that's always been a practice. And Constantine, what he did was he created a welfare system that would primarily give to poor families in order to feed their children, so that they wouldn't kill them off in order to survive. And that was what I would consider an actual right means for doing welfare. To actually help people put food in their mouth and not enable them not to do anything at all in order to protect children. That was kind of a great opportunity to do a good welfare system. He forbade crucifixion as a penalty for crimes, and he also forbade branding individuals on the face. As he argued, the human face was created to reflect heavenly beauty and should never be disfigured. He also tried to do away with the gladiator competitions, but old habits die hard. And that wouldn't go too well for him, at least in certain places. In the old traditions in Rome, the gladiator competitions would last for many more years to come. And eventually it would be done away with totally. But it was an old habit to die hard. Obviously, they weren't killing Christians in the gladiators. They were just doing gladiator fights. And this was something that would take a long time But to even see Constantine's heart of recognizing that that was wrong, to put people against each other, to fight to the death for competition and for show, for him to even see that to what was an old tradition and to consider that morally wrong, it shows that there was something taking place in Constantine's heart. Whether you agree with what it was or not, there was something happening that was quite different. One of his most historic decisions was to build a new capital city for the Eastern Empire of Byzantium in Thrace, just across the sea from Asia Minor. And it was finished in 330. This city would become known as Constantinople. Constantine wanted it to be named New Rome, but all of his followers decided to call it Constantinople, the city of Constantine. And that today is modern-day Istanbul, Turkey. If you go to Istanbul, you are standing in Constantinople. It was changed to Istanbul when the Ottoman Turks came in and crushed and invaded the empire and took that area over, took Turkey over. What's amazing is now what is one of the most Muslim countries in the world, and Turkey's primarily in Istanbul, was at one point one of the most thriving Christian cities in the world. And if you go to Istanbul, if you ever get a chance to visit there, there are many ancient churches, many ancient baptismals, many ancient things to look there that are still left there, shockingly. But I think because Turkey primarily is a very moderate Muslim country, that is why a lot of those antiquity things from antiquity, still exist there and haven't been destroyed, which you cannot say if you go to places like Palestine and other places like that. Constantinople was to be a Christian city from the outset. The gladiator games were never held there. And after the West collapsed in 410 AD, so the West collapsed, the Western Empire of Rome collapsed way before the Eastern Empire did. So when we talk about the collapse of Rome in 410 AD to the Visigoths, what we're talking about is simply the western part of the empire. The rest of the empire pulled into the east, and the Eastern Empire reigned for many years to come through that. In spite of all that Constantine did to advance Christianity, paganism remained the religion of the majority of the empire's citizens. Yet again, this is a very false and anachronistic view of history. You'll hear many say, well, Constantine came in and just forced everybody to become Christian. That's what happened. Well, not at all. That's not even remotely historically accurate. Constantine didn't do that. You'll hear Constantine told the bishops what they had to put in the Bible and what they had to leave out. Not even remotely true. We'll look at the Council of Nicaea next week and we'll see that what happened in Nicaea had absolutely nothing to do with that. The main effect of Constantine's conversion was the changed relationship between the emperor and the affairs of the church. Constantine allowed for total freedom of religion, but he did do away with witchcraft. You couldn't do witchcraft in the empire. That was something that was totally forbidden. And private sacrifices. You could not do that. So what changed was not that Christianity became the state religion, but what took place was that now the affairs of the state and the affairs of the church became greatly intertwined, and they were almost inseparable at many times, even at the earliest portions here. In the ancient world, the state and religion were always joined together. There was no such thing as a secular state. Even when it was a pagan empire, they still were pagan. They would offer sacrifices as leaders. They would do these things. The idea of a secular state is not going to even be remotely thought of until we get to the Enlightenment. The French Revolution and things like that, where we start getting into the idea of having a secular state. We'll look at the rise of the American concept of the separation between state and church. And so that will be, it'll be interesting to see how such a later reality, how the state and the church were always so intertwined with any regard, any kind of religion, even when Christianity was not a main religion in the empire or inside that, there was still always a religious influence. You see that throughout all the Old Testament, right? When you see the rise of the Babylonians and the Syrians, there's always this idea of leaders sacrificing to gods in order to try and gain favor. So this idea of a secular state is going to be a very much enlightened concept that will come out of the Enlightenment. We'll see the seeds of it in the separation of church and state in America, and you will see the horrible realities of it when you get to communism and the French Revolution and things like that, where God is totally cut out of the state, and you will see nothing but massacre and genocide. Constantine did exactly this. He felt he owed his position as an emperor to the will of the Christian God, and that he must further the interests of God's church if he was to continue to enjoy God's blessing. Constantine therefore intervened as a Christian emperor to try to settle two main controversies that were disturbing the peace of the Christian community. So, before this time, emperors saw themselves as one who needed to keep the peace of the empire, the Pax Romana, the peace of Rome. And so anything that they could do to help keep stability in the pagan religion at the time, they would do. And Constantine, as a Christian, saw himself doing no different. If he is going to be a good Christian, and he has the power that he has, then he should help, you know, come and settle disputes for the church with his authority and with his power. And that's exactly what he would do. So the two new controversies arise. We'll look at the smaller one, the one that is not, it's significant, but not as significant. And then we'll look at the major controversy, which would lead to the Council of Nicaea. The first controversy was Donatism. The last persecution of Diocletian left the church in Northwest Africa extremely divided. Many Christians failed to recognize the new bishops of Carthage because he had been ordained by a leader who had allegedly handed the Bible over to be burnt. They didn't like that. They did not accept the authority of the bishop of Carthage because they believed the guy that ordained him had capitulated in the persecutions and gave a Bible to be burnt. So they did not consider his ordination to be valid. And so the church split into two camps, and both claimed Catholicity. Now, if you're new and you haven't been here, what that simply means is they claim to be the true church. They claim to be belonging to the universal and orthodox church of Christ. And so both of them claim to be the true church. They both claim Catholicity, and honestly, they both agreed on the exact same thing when it came to doctrine. One was led by Cecilian, who was the bishop of Carthage, and the other by a rival bishop named Donatus, which is where we get the Donatist name from. The Donatists believed that the efficacy of a performed sacrament was based upon moral character of the minister. If a minister had sinned badly, then all of his baptisms would be considered invalid. So let me just give you an example. Say you're sitting here, you get a call, you find out that the pastor who baptized you has had an affair with a secretary. Your baptism has now been invalid. And now you need to go get rebaptized by someone who is morally capable of doing it. And so the efficacy of a sacrament, they taught, was based upon the moral character of the one administering the sacrament. They began to practice rebaptism, which really rubbed the church wrong, because they were saying that the church had lost its authority. They were saying that the authority of a minister to do that was not based upon the authority of the church, the authority that comes with being a gospel church, a biblical church. That the authority was intrinsic to the minister himself. And this will continue to grow. What's interesting is the Donatist controversy will get completely snuffed out primarily by Augustine. Augustine will absolutely destroy it in his apology in about 100 years. But what's interesting is the church later on will adopt Donatist notions in order to talk and teach the doctrine of transubstantiation. That is this, that the priest, when he says the words of the Mass, that he has an intrinsic power in his ability, in his speech, to turn the elements into the literal body and blood of Jesus. That he has the mystical power to do so. And that even if he falls, say he could leave tomorrow, a priest could come in here and say, I denounce the faith, I denounce Christ. I believe all of it's hogwash. It's all garbage. The Catholic Church teaches that that priest, because he has been given that sacrament, can do and perform that sacrament his whole life, even as an atheist. He has the power to turn blood and wine into the literal body and blood of Jesus Christ and perform the doctrine of the Mass and transubstantiation. So what's interesting is they will deny the Donatists, and they'll say they're wrong for this, but then they will teach about a thousand years later that priests have an intrinsic mystical power in themselves to efficate the sacrament, which they said that they couldn't do 1,000 years before. So here we'll start seeing the contradictions take place. When Constantine became ruler of the West, he ruled that any property confiscated during the persecution was to be returned. And so anything that Diocletian took in the mid-3rd century, he said, just let us know and we will give back everything that you lost as a Christian. We'll give back everything that we can. We'll give that back to you. And so the authorities gave all the belongings back to Cecilian, who was the Bishop of Carthage, and his followers. But the Donatists appealed to Constantine to recognize them as the rightful owners of the property on the grounds that they were the one true Catholic Church in Northwest Africa, that they were the one true church. Those other ones, they're all moral failures. They don't have right sacraments. They have bad ministers. We're the one true church. We should receive the property that was taken. Constantine was reluctant to decide the issue personally. This will be the first and last time he's reluctant in doing a lot of things like this. But he was right in doing this. He was reluctant, and so he allowed various tribunals of bishops to decide the matter. He allowed the church to deal with it. This is your matter, you deal with it. And the matter went against the Donatists. The Donatists were told to be the group that was wrong. They were not branded as heretics, meaning they didn't have a wrong doctrine. As far as their theology wasn't wrong, they just had a wrong view of ecclesiology, meaning how the church functioned. Where does the authority of a minister come from? And the authority of a minister is not intrinsic to himself. It is given to him by the word which he proclaims. That is where the authority of a minister comes from. It is not from himself. It is the message which he heralds that gives him the authority. And it is the church that recognizes and sets him apart with the authority as they have seen God work in that person's life to set them apart. It's why ordination is an act of the church, not external to the church. So the Southern Baptist Convention doesn't come down and send 20 people from the Southern Baptist Convention to ordain me. We have people from the convention that come who are going to simply check to make sure that the church has done right in setting an individual apart to make sure this person is right theologically, doctrinally, and understands his role as a minister and a leader. And so they are just coming to help serve as a supplement to what the church has done to set apart. But we start seeing all of this beginning to be shaken up here in these controversies. But it didn't stop the matter. The Donatists didn't take this easy. They started to become violent. There were outbreaks. There were riots that were taking place in this area in Northwest Africa. So the violent outbreak caused Constantine to order the African authorities in 316 to exile all Donatists and confiscate their church buildings. And so now we start seeing this is huge. For the first time, a secular civil authority makes a binding judgment on a church doctrinal matter. This is huge. Constantine hoped that this would solve the issue, but it failed to persuade the Donatists to return under the Cecilian and the church in Carthage. This is the thing. They believed the same things. The issue was over morality and how bishops should be taken into the church, how they should be ordained. It was very much a tertiary matter. And the hope was that in doing this, maybe in scaring them, that they would come underneath and say, all right, we can agree to disagree on this matter. We're still brothers and sisters in the faith. We believe the same major doctrines. Let's just come together. But that's not what happened. Yes. He exiled them from the entire empire. Well, but it was based upon the doctrine that he exiled them from the empire. Right? They were excommunicated from the church by Cecilian, but now he takes that excommunication and exiles them from the empire based upon the unrest on a doctrinal matter. And so, at this point, it was very light, right? Because the church could still say, well, we were the ones who made the efficacious rule on the matter of the doctrine. And like you said, Constantine just made a civil discussion to exile them out of the empire because they were causing civil unrest. Unfortunately, that's not how it would be interpreted. It was that now he would have authority to basically push religious dissenters and either force them to convert or force them out of the empire. And that was going to be the precedent that was set from this. In 321, Constantine acknowledged his failure and canceled the decree. For the next 100 years, the Christians of Northwest Africa would be equally divided between the Catholics and the Donatists. Augustine would deal the final death blow to the Donatists through a powerful apologetic against them. Constantine's intervention in the Donatist controversy meant that for the first time, an emperor had used the power of the state to try and force dissenting Christians back into fellowship, which was recognized as the true church. And this was the seed that would grow into a horrifying reality for the church within a few centuries. Because within a few centuries, any religious nonconformist, anybody who would not concede or convert to Christianity, would be hailed to the knife and be killed by the state. And so this would set the precedent. A small one, something that I don't think should have been taken that way. I agree, it should have just been something seen as a civil matter. Unfortunately, it set a precedent that would become lasting. And as we grow into the more and dark ages, we start getting into the Crusades, would become a very dark and dangerous reality as the church and the state would be equal. They would grow equal, fully intertwined, and therefore the church would now wield the power of the sword against people that would not consent or convert to Christianity. Arianism. Arianism is the big one. Arianism is the controversy. It is the heresy that would lead into the Council of Nicaea. So this is the most important and the greatest theological controversy in all of church history. There has not been a single controversy that has even come close to equating the level of danger that was put on the church and put on the church's doctrine like Arianism was. It was centered on the most fundamental of all questions: who is Jesus Christ? Is He God in the flesh, or is He just a created being like us? That was the question. The church had inherited a strong monotheism from its Jewish roots. We are monotheist as Christians, strongly monotheist. And it now had to work out how that monotheism related to the adoring worship it offered to Jesus of Nazareth. So how does this work? They're still trying to figure this out. This really hasn't been a major issue to this point. They've talked about some of the conflicts around who Jesus was, how did that all work. We saw a little bit of Origen and his doctrine of eternal generation. We saw a little bit that this has been worked out, but for the most part, people just accepted Jesus as God and as one who should receive worship. There wasn't really much scholarly debate or talk about it at that time. And so, this was the question: how are we monotheists, but also worshiping Jesus of Nazareth? How does that work? When Constantine conquered the Eastern Empire, he found that the Eastern Church was divided by a fierce doctrinal dispute. Arius, a popular preacher from Libya, had started teaching that the Father alone was God, that the Logos, or the Son, was a created being formed out of nothing by the Father before the universe was made. Now, as shocking as we are to hear that, as Trinitarians, as grounded Trinitarians, we stand on the shoulders of giants, beloved. We stand 1,700 years removed from this. We've had a lot of time to think this thing through. This was all very new, this level of controversy, especially an open controversy. But what saddens and breaks my heart is they just did a state of theology, a survey. Ligonier Ministries did a survey of 5,000 American professing evangelicals. It wasn't they just asked people. These were professing evangelicals who said that they attended church at least 2 times a month. And this 78% of them believed Arius' doctrine. They believed Jesus is the first and greatest created being. That is a damnable heresy, beloved. That is a damnable heresy. Jesus is not the first created being. He is the second member of the triune God, co-equal and co-eternal with the Father and the Spirit. And so, be weary as we look at this and we go, oh, how could they believe that? There is almost 80% of Christians today who call themselves professing evangelicals in this nation who believe the exact same thing. Yes. Primarily, so we'll see. Arius had a tutor that came out of the Antiochian school that very much held to a similar teaching. It primarily came out of the Gnostics and it flowed out of that. It wasn't essentially Gnostic because they still believed Jesus was a man. He was a fleshly being. He was good, that the matter was good. So it wasn't fully Gnostic, but the idea of how do we worship the Father and how do we worship the Son and be fully monotheist, right? Like, that's the question. How does that work? And so, really, it came out of just trying to think through something philosophically, allowing a lot more Greek philosophy to determine how they thought than it was by just simply accepting Scripture with what it said. See, at this point, what we call most of the early Christians is we call them experiential Trinitarians. Meaning, they had not really formally set out a single doctrine of the Trinity, right? Like there wasn't a systematic answer like we have today. They just believed in one God existing in the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And that's just what they did. That's what their Scripture said. And so they just believed it. They didn't really play the let's try to figure it out game, which I think sometimes is a wise stance. So they were what we call experiential Trinitarians. They lived life in light of the Trinity. They prayed to the Father. Their redemption came through the Son. And they believed in their empowering ability through the Spirit, right? That's just what they believed. And so, this was the first time where people started going, well, how? How does that work? And so, that's really what this formed out of. What we're going to see is Arius wasn't just trying to go after Jesus. He wasn't trying to do that. He had a very high view of monotheism. And he's just trying to figure out, how do we balance that? Right? And so, he went the wrong direction. But Origen did the same thing last week. Origen taught that the Son was eternal, that He was begotten of the Father, that they were co-eternal together, but they weren't co-equal. He taught that the Son was a little bit inferior. And He did that based upon His Platonic understanding of the nature of divines, lesser divines and things like that. And so, it's hard to say where it fully rooted out of. We believe that Arius' primary teacher out of Antioch is the one that kind of started really permeating this, but Arius is the one that brought it to its full-formed understanding. So really, this is the root of it, if we should say, the origins of a full-blown understanding of Jesus as a created being. Yes. Jehovah's Witnesses. And I wouldn't call them a domination, but a cult, yes. There's not really any Christian denomination that we would consider that holds to Arianism. But Jehovah's Witnesses hold to it to almost a T. The only variance between Arianism and Jehovah's Witnesses is that Jehovah's Witnesses believe that He was created as Michael the Archangel. And that when Michael the Archangel was incarnated as Jesus of Nazareth. But once He was crucified, He went back to being Michael the Archangel. Mormonism is that everybody's ultimately a created being. There is an infinite number of gods. That Elohim Himself was a created man at one time, and elevated himself to godhood, which they can too by fulfilling all of the priestly ordinances and things like that, temple marriage and whatnot. Jesus, along with all of us, was simply other created beings. And that Jesus, in the premortal existence, God put forth a plan of creation, Elohim put forth a plan of creation, and two brothers, Satan and Jesus, put forth a plan. And Satan said, well, let's just make them all robots and they'll be saved. And Jesus said, no, let's make them have to love you and yada, 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 you get it. And God the Father picked Jesus' plan over his brother Satan. Satan had an angry sibling rivalry moment and rebelled, and that's how we got the fall. So, yeah, and after we do our church history, we're going to do a series on the kingdom of the cults, and I'm going to go over all that. But yeah, so just as the modern-day Jehovah's Witnesses are Arians through and through, with the exception that Jesus was not created as Jesus. He was created as Michael the Archangel, incarnated as Jesus, now is back as Michael the Archangel. Which is why when you see, for them, the view of the rapture, when you hear the cry of the Archangel, that's Michael, that's the second coming, they teach. And so that's what they would argue for that as well. Islam is weird in that, and I don't mean that as like weird, I mean Islam is weird in that when you look at Muhammad rising up specifically in the eastern part of Christianity, which at that time Eastern Christianity was predominantly Arian. Arianism almost takes over the eastern part of the church for about two centuries. It becomes the dominant theology of the eastern part of the church. Muhammad comes up in a time of mystical Judaism, Kabbalah and things like that, a false view of Christianity. And he's trying to figure out, well, who's right? And so when you read Muhammad's understanding of Christianity in the Quran, his view of the Trinity is God the Father, the Son, and Mary. Now where does that? That shows me that either Allah's dumb because he doesn't even know the Christian doctrine of the Trinity, or Muhammad was just a man trying to figure out religion, utilizing the sources that he had around him and compiling a religious document no different than what Joseph Smith did. And if you ever want to compare two things, Islam and Mormonism, you'll have your mind blown. Which just shows me Satan does nothing new under the sun. Both of the men believed that they had an angel come to them and give them divine tablets and writings and just polygamy, you name it, all of it. It's just unbelievable when you do a parallel religion study of Mormonism and Islam. But let's try to finish up here. It's all that the sun was the first and greatest of all that God had created. He was closer to God than all others, and the rest of creation related to God through the sun. Only the Father, however, was truly God, infinite, eternal, and uncreated. Arius thought that in teaching this, he was protecting Christian monotheism from polytheism. So he thought he was doing a good thing. Because he thought, well, if you worship God the Father, and you worship God the Son, then now you have two gods, and now we're polytheists. That's how it has to work. Arius also disagreed with Origen, that there could be degrees of divinity, where the Son could simply be a lesser divine than the Father. That's where Origen went wrong. Origen was right in teaching the eternal reality of the Son, wrong in teaching that the Son was subordinate or inferior to the Father. When you look at the Trinity, the Son takes a subordinate role to the Father, not because of His ontological nature, but because of His volitional desire to submit to the Father. It is a free volition to submit to the will of the Father, and it's no different with the Spirit. There's nothing ontologically different or inferior about their natures. They are all equally God, sharing the one divine nature. But they take subordinate roles within the triune nature about what functions they will serve in the role of governing the universe. How will they do it? So we see the Father's plan, the Father's will, the Son's execution, the Son's work in redeeming, and the Spirit's role in empowering and preserving His church. And so it's a beautiful Trinitarian flow of redemptive work through all of them. Even in creation, we see the Father's will to create and the Son as the agent of creation. We read that in Colossians 1 and 2. And so there is no inferior by nature, But there is a free volitional submission by the Son to freely choose to submit to the Father and place Himself subordinate to. But they are both co-equal and co-eternal, one God in three persons. This, unfortunately, had become a major teaching among Eastern bishops because of Origen's influence. Arius taught that since God was clearly identified as the Father, then nothing else could be God. And as you see there, Arius' view of Christ is almost identical to modern Jehovah's Witnesses. Arius was strongly opposed by his bishop Alexander. Alexander, unlike many other Eastern bishops, disagreed with Origen's teachings as well. He thought both of them are wrong. Where Origen had said that the Logos or Son was slightly less divine than the Father, Arius said that He was not divine at all, and He was a created being. Alexander invited that the Son was fully and truly God in as absolute a sense as the Father was. The problem for Alexander, though, was to show that this view did not lead to a belief in two gods, as Arius maintained it did. In 320, Alexander assembled a council of Egyptian bishops which disposed Arius for heresy. Arius was, however, not ready to give up without a fight and went to Palestine, canvassing support from other Eastern bishops. He had a ready-made network of contacts because many of the Middle Eastern clergy had, like Arius himself, studied under the learned Lucian of Antioch, head of the Antiochian Theological School, who died as a martyr in 312. Arius wrote letters to Lucian's ex-students who now held church offices. And Lucian had similar views to Arius, and many call him the father of Arianism, since it was overwhelmingly his students that formed this movement. So we don't have a lot of teachings of Lucian, but the fact that Arius reached out to all of his former classmates under Lucian, the fact that he was reaching out to them primarily, and that they made up the brunt of what would become the Arian movement, specifically in leadership, it's easy to say that it is likely that Lucian was the one who was first espousing Jesus as a created being, the first and greatest created being. Arius' method proved very successful for popularizing his causes, with the result that church leaders throughout the East became caught up in the dispute and began to take sides either with Arian or with Alexander. Of the few bishops who supported Arius, only a few even understood and actually believed Arius' doctrine that the Son was a created being. Most of them even know what the heck was going on. They just picked a side with a friend. They were really confused at the language that was used. However, many others found the controversy deeply confusing, because in some ways, Arius seemed to be closer than Alexander to the traditional Eastern theology derived from Origen, which said that the Son was inferior to the Father. So at this point, the predominant teaching in the East, not the West, in the East, was that the Trinity existed, but that the Son and the Spirit each represented a level of divinity slightly lesser than the Father. The Son was slightly less divine than the Father. The Spirit was slightly less divine than the Son. And that was Origen's kind of concept of the Trinity. And many Eastern bishops, just because of Origen's acclaim, went with that. But Alexander was the first one really in the East to take a bold stance and say, no, He is equal with the Father. He is co-eternal and co-equal with the Father. And so many of them were confused where they were even supposed to argue, because Arius was closer to Origen, but he was still saying that now Jesus isn't divine at all. And that was really confusing for a lot of them. Alexander was the one challenging the originist position by saying that the Son was equal with the Father in possessing the full divine nature, which according to Arius meant a belief in two separate gods. Every time that Alexander would propose that Jesus was fully God and fully man, Arius would say, well, now you're a polytheist. You can't be a monotheist. And that's all he would say. That's all he would rebuke back with. There was no understanding of natures versus personas. There was no concept of that. And so it became just this constant talking past one another of Alexander saying, no, they are one God, co-equal and co-eternal, but he quite wasn't able to substantiate the persona concept, three persons, one being. And so Arius just kept saying, well, you're just a polytheist, and that's the end of the story. He's like, all right, man, we can't figure anything out. So, on the other hand, Arius himself was teaching that the Son was a created being, which was certainly not what Origen had said. So the Eastern Church became increasingly perplexed and divided. Constantine felt that it was his duty as a Christian emperor to restore unity in his church and to his empire's divided church. He therefore summoned the first ecumenical council of church history. He summoned bishops from all over the Eastern Empire and a few from the West to settle the dispute. And this council met at Nicaea in Northwest Asia Minor in 325 AD. And that's where we'll pick up next week, at the Council of Nicaea. And that is one thing. There are a few dates you need to know in history. You need to know the Council of Nicaea happened in 325 AD. And what we learn about next week about the Council of Nicaea is perhaps the most important, one of the most important lessons that we will have here in church history, because one of the biggest falsehoods that is proposed today is that the divinity and the deity of Jesus was invented at Nicaea. That nobody believed that prior to Nicaea. Now, I've already shown you church fathers beforehand and given you direct quotes that showed you they did. But nevertheless, that is one of the main view teachings. If you ever see, what's that book in the movie? The Da Vinci Code. It's all centered around the Council of Nicaea. The Council of Nicaea just, it supported books of the Bible. It lied about Christ. Christ was married to Mary Magdalene and they had a kid and she's this special person, and you know, all of these things. And so, all of this hogwash is centered around the mystery of the Council of Nicaea. And what we're going to see, there's really no mystery at all of what gets taken care of there. It's a very important Council of Church history, and so look forward to that. But it is very important, because most of the secular attacks on Christianity will be immediately taken to the Council of Nicaea, and they will say, that's where the church picked the books of the Bible. That's where these things happened. That's where Jesus became God, and nobody believed that beforehand. And you'll just see that all of that is just absurd when you actually take the time to see what did happen at Nicaea. All right, let's close in prayer. Father God, we thank You so much.